Let's go back to the relativity principle. I mentioned before that the Galilean Newtonian relativity principle is really universal. And there's no reason to think, in particular for Newton, that electromagnetic forces would provide a counterexample to the relativity principle. Now, of course, there was a fundamental shift in thinking in the 19th century. When electromagnetism was understood to be a field theory, and that light in particular was some kind of disturbance in an underlying medium, then of course this medium was expected to break the symmetry in exactly the same way that air does in the understanding of sound. You don't expect the Galilean relativity principle, for example, to apply to the equations of sound, unless you're prepared to boost the medium along with everything else. But of course, that's exactly what you can't do with the electromagnetic ether, luminiferous ether. So there was no reason to expect in the 19th century, given the vast success of the field theory of electromagnetism, Maxwell's theory in principle, for the relativity principle to apply to electromagnetism. So the issue wasn't so much, is the relativity principle right or wrong? The issue is, what is its scope? And so all that Einstein did, as a result of, probably as a result of watching all of the null results of the Ethwind experiments, was to do exactly what basically Poincaré and Lorentz effectively had already done, more Poincaré than Lorentz, and just say, look, there just isn't an experiment you can perform in electromagnetism that will pick out the preferred frame. All the empirical evidence was pointing in this direction. So what was Einstein doing? He was returning the relativity principle to its original form. That's to say, a universal principle. That's all he was doing. It's not a new principle at all. It's really the original Newton principle. The same law of electrodynamics and optics will be valid for all coordinate systems in which the equations of mechanics hold good, as has already been shown for quantities of first order. He's not referring to the Michelson-Morley experiment here, which refers to quantities in the second order in V over C, but he certainly knew about it. And it's a mystery why he doesn't mention the Michelson-Morley experiment in his paper. There's no doubt at all he knew about it. We shall raise this conjecture, whose content will hereafter be called the principle of relativity, to the status of a postulate. And then later he goes on to say more explicitly what the postulate is. If two coordinate systems are in uniform parallel translational motion relative to each other, the laws according to which the states of a physical system change do not depend on which of the two systems these changes are related to. Notice again, no reference here to specific form of coordinate transformations, which is just as well. He's going to use this principle to derive the Lorentz transformations. But notice one subtlety here. In the exact form, in the precise form of the relativity principle, Einstein says two coordinate systems in uniform parallel translational motion relative to each other. He doesn't say that they're inertial. Now, it's clear he's thinking of inertial frames. There's no doubt about it. I'm not trying to argue that one can do some exotic exegesis here and you can convince yourself that actually he meant something stronger than he meant this literally. He refers, for example, to coordinate systems in which the equations of mechanics hold good. And at one stage, he actually says the Newtonian laws of motion. It's clear that he's referring to inertial coordinates. But nonetheless, there's a question of interest that I'll return to in a moment. Could this be valid independently of the inertial coordinates? Could it just be valid for any pair of coordinate systems in relative motion? Now, of course, we know that if you just have the relativity principle, you will not get the Lorentz transformation. How do we know that? Because Einstein used the relativity principle and got the Galilean transformation. It's far too weak a constraint to fix the coordinate transformation. So you know you've got to put in something else. Einstein used Newton's second law and the conjecture that all the fundamental forces and masses are velocity independent. Einstein used a different postulate. And the postulate, of course, is the light postulate, and it is not the invariance of the speed of light. How could it be? The invariance of the speed of light is not logically independent of the relativity principle. Einstein says, consider a rest frame. Now, what did he really mean? He meant his readers to think the frame in which Maxwell's equations are valid. Now, what frame is that? That's the E for rest frame, according to his readers. So, consider a rest frame. Every ray of light moves in the rest coordinate system with a definite velocity v, independently of whether this ray is emitted by a body at rest or in motion. In other words, the speed of light is independent of the speed of the source in that rest frame. Why is this plausible? Why is it plausible? There were no direct experimental evidence for this in 1905. Why is this plausible? Think of Maxwell's equations. Now, of course, Einstein never appeals to Maxwell's equations in the early part of his paper. Does anyone know why he doesn't appeal to the form of Maxwell's equations? Because a few months before he published this paper, he published his paper in the light quantum. The light quantum is inconsistent with Maxwell's equations. Einstein was the only person in 1905 who did not believe in the validity, the strict validity of Maxwell's equations. So he's not going to use his derivation of the Lorentz transformations as being the symmetry group of Maxwell's equations when he knows that they're not fundamental. And he was unique in this sense at the time. So he's appealing to something that held in the ether theories. It was absolutely natural. What is it? If light is the propagation of a disturbance in the medium, as sound is a propagation of a disturbance in air, of course it doesn't depend on the speed of the source. It depends on the elastic properties of the medium. By the way, you don't need that argument for Einstein. He doesn't believe in the ether, as we'll see in a minute. But then how do you justify this? Well, all the successes of the ether theory were based on the assumption that the speed of light is independent of the speed of the source, and this is also a consequence of Maxwell's equation. So Einstein is simply saying he's performing a Wittgensteinian act of kicking away the ladder. Pauli correctly said in 1921, this is the true essence of the old ether point of view. So Einstein is stealing from the ether theorists their fundamental phenomenological principle. The speed of light is independent of the speed of the source in the rest frame. Now, how Einstein thought he could get away with this, given that he had a notion of a light quantum, which is more like a bullet than a wave. But this assumption here really only makes sense in the wave theory of light. This represents the remarkable nature of Einstein's intuition in 1905, that he could still postulate, he could still extract this fundamental principle from the ether theories, despite the fact that he knew that light had a granular structure, and he knew he could get away with it. Well, how do these principles work together? If you put the two principles together, you conclude immediately that the speed of light is invariant. Well, almost immediately. Almost immediately. I'll come back to that later, perhaps. But in Einstein's, I forgot something. There's another principle you need in the derivation of Lorentz transformation, another symmetry principle. Spatial isotropy. We'll see how that works right now. So let's look at what Einstein did in 1905. Again, I'm sure that this is very, very familiar to you, but just to lay out some of the details, Einstein has the relativity principle and the light postulate. It's very important to note, by the way, that he introduces a very important synchrony convention. You should start with this. Because this is telling you how to interpret the temporal coordinates in your coordinate system. And this is the synchrony convention whereby you choose a coordinate system, whether it's the rest coordinate system or the moving coordinate system, such that relative to that coordinate system, the one-way speed of light is isotropic. Now, we know that the two-way speed of light is isotropic because of the Michelson-Morley experiment. That's exactly what it established, that the two-way speed of light is isotropic. When you rotate the interferometer, nothing happens. But what about the one-way speed? One-way speeds are not measurable directly of anything, not just light, of anything at all. Because in order to measure a one-way speed, you need to have synchronized clocks at a distance. And how you synchronize clocks is a question of convention. And actually, Einstein wasn't so much interested in synchronized distant clocks. He was really interested in coordinate systems. How do you choose a coordinate system? How do you spread the phase of time through space? So he chose the natural convention, which is the Poincaré-Einstein convention, that the one-way speed of light is isotropic. Now, that gives him the invariance of the one-way light speed, putting those things together. And that gives rise to the so-called K. Lorentz transformations. It's easy to convince yourself that if you have the invariance of the one-way speed of light, then the coordinate transformations in the standard configuration have to take the form k gamma x minus vt, y prime is equal to ky, z prime is equal to kz, and t prime is equal to k times gamma t minus xv of c squared. And incidentally, the x of, I beg your pardon, the v of a c squared, which is the alpha term we saw before, that generalized coefficient of relativity of simultaneity, that follows merely from the choice of how you've, the convention you've used for synchronizing distant clocks. It has nothing to do with the invariance of the speed of light. It's a direct consequence of having chosen your convention the way you did in both the moving and the rest frame. But now we have this awkward scale factor that's still sitting in the coordinate transformation. This scale factor, in general, will be a function of v, the relative speed between the two frames. And you want it to go to unity. Now, the question is, how do you make it unity? Now, you know that it's going to be there, because if you think of the velocity transformations that derive that are a consequence of these coordinate transformations, you can see immediately that the k's will vanish, will cancel. Because a velocity transformation involves a distance measure over a time measure. And the k's, of course, will cancel, top and bottom. So any velocity transformation arising out of the coordinate transformation will be insensitive to the k. So you haven't fixed the value of k yet. But of course, the velocity transformations will tell you whether or not the one-way speed of light is invariant. And we're assuming that it is. So now the question is, how do you fix k? Well, you could say, let's impose the relativity principle. Let's suppose that these transformations have to form a group. And that's a consequence of the relativity principle. Actually, it's quite a subtle consequence. But let's assume for the moment we can make that connection. These must form a group if the relativity principle is valid. But now you can choose a value of k, which takes the following form, c plus v with a c minus v to the power of n, where n is any real number. This is in the case of 2 plus 1. I should, ignoring, in the case of 1 plus 1 dimension, so ignoring the transverse coordinates. In other words, imagine we have a 1 plus 1 spacetime. Then you can choose, you can do this in four dimensions as well, but it looks simplest in the case of 1 plus 1. Choose that factor, and it turns out that the transformations form a group. So they're consistent with the relativity principle. They're also consistent with the light postulate, because these things ensure that this one-way speed of light is invariant. So how come we don't see these in the textbooks? And these are I refer to these as the Boguslavsky-Budden transformations. Boguslavsky originally discovered these in 1977. And they were rediscovered several times later, independently. Yeah, 1977. Yeah. So the question is, why don't we conclude, therefore, that the Lorentz transformations are a bit too strong? That if just according to the fundamental postulates of special relativity, we could have transformations that look quite different. And the reason is because that is not an even function of v. What does that mean? That term here, take, for example, this factor. This is equal to 1 over the longitudinal length change factor. that will determine the length change factor. Because that's not an even function of v, it turns out that if we boost a rod in that direction, and we boost a rod in that direction, the opposite direction, with equal speeds, they're going to contract by different amounts. And that violates the isotropy of space. So we're going to impose spatial isotropy. So it really does, spatial isotropy is a very important assumption. It should be put alongside the relativity principle for its importance in deriving the Lorentz transformations. Now, it's easy to show that if you introduce isotropy and you get rid of all these functions that are not even functions of V, it's very easy to show that K must be equal to 1. So you get the Lorentz transformations. So this is the famous, this is the case that really woke physicists up to the fact that by imposing a symmetry condition, or maybe more than one symmetry condition, you get out something very, very important. You fix the nature of the coordinate transformation. And now, if you want to, you can say, yes, the relativity principle can be restated as the Lorentz covariance of the fundamental laws, non-gravitational interactions, only at this stage. Now, Ignatovsky, some years later, decided to give up on the light postulate and just to use the relativity principle. Well, not quite. We've seen already, of course, that the relativity principle is too weak to give us the coordinate transformations, but nonetheless, you can see how they do constrain the coordinate transformations. And Ignatovsky's approach to the coordinate transformations has been rediscovered several times independently in the literature since 1910, 1911. In particular, in the 1970s, Lee and Kolodas discovered them. Levi-LeBlanc rediscovered them independently about a year later. And they reappear in textbooks quite frequently. For example, in Rindler's books on special relativity, you'll find a section on relativity without the light postulate. And just to remind you how this goes, you assume the phenomenological relativity principle. What is this doing? It's ensuring that the coordinate transformations form a group. That's the work that they play, that the principle plays. Now, one of the subtleties that's not always discussed in the accounts of this in the textbooks, how did Ignatovsky think he was synchronizing his clocks? Now, you see, Einstein was using light because light had a very, very special property. It was independent of the speed of the source. And because of the relativity principle, he knew it would be invariant, and it's a natural structure to latch on to. What was Ignatovsky supposed to latch on to? He was choosing his coordinates implicitly in such a way that effectively he was saying of two distant events whether they were simultaneous or not. Let's say in the rest frame, the unprimed frame. Well, what was the convention? It's difficult to say. I'm not sure that Ignatovsky himself spelt this out. But one thing that you could say, if you were reconstructing the argument, would be something like the following. Let's suppose there exists a convention relative to which rods and clocks, when they undergo changes due to motion, do it isotropically. I'm just saying this is one way you could do it. So I'm going to assume that's what we're doing. There exists a convention with respect to both frames, the prime, the unprime, and the prime frames, such that when we define the one-way speed of rods and clocks in opposite directions, we find that any kinematical effects they suffer due to motion will be isotropic. Now, it's not trivial that there exists such a thing, but let's just assume it does. He also assumed reciprocity and the isotropy of space. Now, reciprocity, remember, is the claim that the relative motion in that direction is minus v. And I made the claim, the remark before, that once you've chosen your synchrony convention, this is an empirical fact. It's an empirical question. It's not a convention. There is, interestingly, a paper, I think it's in 1969, by two Italians called Berzi and Gorini. And they prove reciprocity, or attempt to prove it, on the basis of the relativity principle and spatial isotropy. It's a very difficult proof. And I've never seen a sort of simplified version of it. So bear in mind, it may well be, given the result of Berzi and Gorini, that reciprocity is redundant here, because Ignatovsky already has the relativity principle in isotropy. Although Ignatovsky clearly puts reciprocity in by hand. At any rate, if you turn the handle, you end up proving the existence of an invariant speed. So the relativity principle, along with spatial isotropy, a rather natural way of synchronizing distant clocks, gives you, as an outcome, the existence of an invariant speed. The trouble is you don't know what it is. You can't specify it, given the assumptions that you've made. But you end up getting the so-called Ignatovsky transformations, which are just like the Lorentz transformations, except that you now have a universal constant k, which has the dimensions of 1 over the square root of velocity. And k could be 0. That's to say the invariant speed could be infinite. Or k could be finite. If it's infinite, you get the Galilean transformations. If it's finite, what do you get? Well, you get something that looks like the Lorentz transformations. You just don't know how big the invariant speed is. And in particular, you don't have any connection between the invariant speed and life. Why not? Because you haven't put a life postulate in. So this is another interesting example of the use of phenomenological symmetry principles in fixing the nature of the coordinate systems. Whether you can call this the derivation of relativity isn't so clear. Some people say you have derived basically the kinematics of special relativity without using light. But actually, you've derived a one-parameter family of coordinate transformations. And it's less falsifiable, of course, than the Lorentz transformations because they contain the Galilean transformations. Indeed, they even contain transformations where the invariant speed is different from the speed of light. But one thing I wanted to mention was it's rather subtle how the question of the synchrony convention comes in. It turns out that synchrony convention that you put in the beginning is also the convention with respect to which the one-way speed of the invariant speed is isotropic. The one-way invariant speed turns out to be isotropic. Just like light is one-way speed of light is isotropic in the case of the Lorentz transformation. That's something that comes out of the wash. It's not something you can put in from the beginning because you don't know that in the beginning that you have an invariant speed. Well, just a final remark. And this comes back to the question I raised before about the meaning of the relativity principle. Think of 1905. What are the inertial frames in 1905? The inertial frames are the frames relative to which Newton's first law of motion is valid. So if you've got bodies that are moving freely in the world, and you consider the set of all such bodies in the universe, it's a very, very important non-trivial assumption that you can find a coordinate system relative to which all of these bodies move in straight lines at uniform speeds. That's highly non-trivial. In fact, it's staggering when you think about it, because none of the bodies know about each other. They're moving freely. They're not communicating amongst themselves. Anyway, that's what we mean by an inertial frame. Now, when I take an object like this and I let it go into free fall, is that accelerating with respect to inertial frames or not? Well, it depends on your theory of gravity. Now, Newton said that a freely falling body is accelerating. With respect to what? With respect to an inertial frame. Is there any hint in 1905 that Einstein thought differently? No. So inertial frames in 1905 are not freely falling frames. Whatever they are, they're not freely falling. But if you introduce transformations between them, linear transformations, these things will be symmetries because of the relativity principle and so on. The relativity principle defined with respect to inertial coordinate systems, which themselves are not freely falling. But some years later, the freely falling frames in general relativity become the inertial frames locally. Now the relativity principle is defined as linear transformations between freely falling frames. That's a different principle, isn't it? And if you say that that's the fundamental meaning of the relativity principle, given what we know about general relativity, how come we didn't make a mistake when we applied the relativity principle to the wrong sets of frames? How is this, how are we supposed to understand this transition?
How did we get away with it? Has anybody seen a discussion of this in the literature? Well, here's one way of thinking about it. It's amazing that this isn't highlighted more, I think, in standard textbooks. But here's one way of thinking about it.
Remember that in general relativity, a uniform gravitational field is just an accelerating coordinate system, accelerating with respect to the local inertial frames. That's all it is. We talk about the principle of equivalence, and we say a uniform gravitational field is equivalent to an accelerating coordinate system. But the word equivalence here is a terrible misnomer. We're not comparing two things and saying they're, in some sense, one and the same thing. We're just talking about one thing. In general relativity, there just isn't a physical entity that corresponds to a uniform gravitational field. It is just the inertial effects of accelerating coordinate systems, or inertial effects within accelerating coordinate systems. So let's assume then that the relativity principle is valid, as it surely is approximately, because local inertial frames are defined in an approximate sense. Let's assume the relativity principle is locally valid for freely falling frames. You remember in general relativity, how do you define a Lorentz frame? It's a frame, you choose a point in space-time, you choose coordinates such that at that point in space-time, g mu is diagonalized, and the first derivatives of g mu vanish. That's a freely falling Lorentz coordinate system. Linear transformations, the appropriate type, that's to say Lorentz transformations between those frames are associated with the relativity principle. Everything is Lorentz covariant. All the non-gravitational interactions are Lorentz covariant. Good. Now imagine transforming the original frame and then now the boosted frame. They're both freely falling. Imagine introducing uniform accelerations instantaneously with respect to those frames. Wouldn't you expect the physics to be the same in both of those accelerating frames, given that the physics is exactly the same in the unaccelerating ones? Wouldn't you expect that?
So maybe there is a way, a very straightforward way, of going from this to that. I'll leave it at that. Do people have any comments or questions?
Very basic question. It seems to me that you emphasized a lot the distinction between we call it physical symmetries, relativity principle, and then mathematical incorporation as group transformations and things like that. I wonder if you can even sensibly think about physical transformations like uniform motion, things like that, without mathematical formalization. Could I say, in a sensible way, what is uniform motion with two objects without a mathematical framework for them?
Well, what you can say is the following, and this is enough for the kind of debate that we're having. Suppose we're starting with some frame S. There's also a relatively moving frame, S prime. Now we can determine whether or not S prime is moving uniformly with respect to S without knowing what the coordinate transformation is. We can just look at the origin of that coordinate system and determine, according to our stationary Brogdon clocks associated with S, whether the speed is uniform. You don't need to know what the coordinate transformation is. Okay. So again, Galileo is right. You can tell just by looking at the ship from the shore whether it's moving uniformly in a straight line, even if you don't know what the coordinate transformations are. Does that partially answer the question?
Yeah, in a sense, it answers the question. Then a lot of the argument was about what the actual coordinate transformations are does depend on further assumptions. Yeah. I cannot.
Many further assumptions. Yeah. Many further assumptions.
Could you say something more about, at one point in the first half, you were talking about how engagement is always declared by fiat, that only gauge independent quantities are going to be observable. And then you said, well, why should this be this? Because should we be able to specify in advance which quantities are observable? And then you said something like, why is nature so kind as to ensure the concurrence of the gauge-independent quantities and what we take to be observable quantities? Did I get that right?
You got that right. I mean, it's more than by way of a plea for help. I mean, I don't really understand this myself. It may well be that there's a straightforward argument somewhere to the effect that it couldn't be otherwise. But the theories with a gauge structure have observables that are gauge independent. But I've never seen such an argument. Of course, it's certainly true that if you want to avoid underdetermination, it had better be the case that the observables are gauge independent. That's obvious. The question is why they are. Now, remember what Einstein once said famously to Heisenberg? The theory tells you what you can measure. So when Heisenberg went to Einstein in the mid-20s and said, look what I've been doing with the uncertainty relations. I've been copying you, what you did with your operational approach to rods and clocks in 1905. And Einstein said, you never repeat the same joke twice. And he disavowed this whole approach because he says, look, operationalism is well and good, but that's just good conceptual housekeeping. What really tells you what an observable is the theory itself. It tells you what you can measure and what you can't measure. Now, where in the theory, for example, of electromagnetism, maybe you could say it's the Lorentz force law, but is the Lorentz force law the whole story? That certainly is gauge invariant. But is that the whole story? I mean, shouldn't there be some kind of underpinning? Shouldn't there be some account of how it is that, I don't know, sentient beings or I don't know, information gathering, whatever you call them in quantum mechanics, agents, shouldn't there be some account as to why it is that they register gauge invariant, hopefully gauge invariant observables? I just don't know the answer to this. So if anyone can help me out on this.
I was going to say, well, one thing I was thinking in the back of my mind was that the question you were asking was about why, when we formulate our theories, we could find, for instance, that there's one true gauge that you have a set, but we don't find that, right? Or we don't think we find that. So that would be another way, another possibility that's getting ruled out.
What would it mean to have one true gauge? What would that mean?
You mean how would we know what it was?
I'm just asking, spell out what you mean by saying that they make this one true gauge or something like that.
Well, I was thinking that would be a way of fixing the gauge. Then you don't have the problem that you're restricted to the gauge invariant.
But you're still going to face this problem of undetermination, because given a solution, even if you've got some natural gauge, you can generate a new solution which agrees with all the data associated with the original gauge on some Cauchy surface, but it will differ everywhere else. So what are you supposed to say about that second solution? It's true that it only came about because you were choosing a different gauge, but are you saying that that would just be a mathematical
artifact? Right.
What I find curious, by the way, just historically, I don't really know how to answer your question, Dorian, but what I find curious is this. When did people first understand the nature of a gauge structure of electromagnetism? when did that come about? I mean, the potential was well known in the 19th century. The fact that you could write Maxwell's equations in terms of a three potential, I mean, a vector potential and scalar, surely well known in the 19th century, no? Now, why did Einstein spend 2 years struggling with the covariant, the general covariance in general relativity? Why didn't he immediately see that this is exactly what's happening in electromagnetism? I don't know why that it wasn't sort of obvious from the beginning.
I mean, electromagnetism was seen as gauge theory much later. Only basically the first gauge theory, which was recognized as gauge theory, was general relativity.
But the idea that you could represent electromagnetic degrees of freedom in terms of a free vector potential and a scalar potential, that was known surely in the 19th century, no?
But nobody spoke of that in that language, really. So basically, the idea of gauge theory is, even like if you look at the particle physics things, became really popular only in the 50s and 60s. So general relativity was really seen as more or less as the first example of general relativity, also it's not really true.
Well, that would certainly explain a lot. It would explain why Einstein was so puzzled by this problem.
I think he just didn't, yeah, it wasn't just, yeah. Just didn't knew in some sense. I mean, he knew probably that it was a potential, but nobody used these words like gauge.
Can I ask a general, sort of, very general historical kind of question? So you said Einstein's work in 1905 sort of elevated the notion of symmetry principles to a kind of pedestal. Well, who before Einstein was kind of really consciously, I mean, who was the earliest person who was doing that consciously? Curious about that.
Lorentz and Poincaré, basically.
So none of these guys like Einstein and so forth wasn't thinking in those terms?
Well, Einstein, of course, is a fable.
Oh, he's not real.
No. I did put a hint at the bottom of the. That's all right.
God, really,
I asked for that. Don't be afraid. You're not the first one. You're not the first one, by any means. I've got people come up to me in conferences and say, God, why have we never discovered Einstein?
Where is archives?
Let's see. Newton's change. We know that in the pre-Principia manuscripts, Newton thought of relativity principles as postulate, and then he thought he could derive it. And in a sense, he is deriving it in the Principia, but he has to introduce this assumption over and above his laws of motion. The fact that the relativity principle is so prominent in the Principia, and it's made into a corollary of the laws of motion, shows that he was thinking very hard. Of course, for Newton, the relativity principle was bittersweet because he could see right from the beginning that it was a fundamental part of mechanics. But it was embarrassing from the point of view of its hiding absolute space. Absolute space was very, very important conceptually for Newton, but the relativity principle precisely tells you you'll never know whether you're at rest with respect to it. So it hides it in some sort of conspiratorial way. And of course, Newton had no way of understanding why this was the case, just apart from the fact that all the forces seem to be mass and velocity. Then in the late 19th century, if you look, for example, at Lorentz's theorem of corresponding states, which was an attempt to show why in the first instance, first-order ether wind experiments were impossible, and then second-order ether wind experiments. That is really an exercise, very, very complicated, by the way, conceptually very complicated exercise of looking at the symmetry properties of Maxwell's equations. So what basically Lorentz was exploiting was the fact that the Maxwell's equations do have this symmetry, boosts the Lorentz covariance. But he didn't understand the Lorentz transformations, coordinate transformations themselves, to be coordinate transformations in the sense of Einstein. They were just essentially mathematical devices. He really still believed in the Galilean transformations in some fundamental sense. But this was really, in a sense, an exercise in symmetry, in the understanding the symmetry properties of field equations. And then Poincaré, of course, Poincaré was just, he had the relativity principle for electromagnetism before Einstein. He just said flat out. Lorentz thought that the relativity principle held up to second order. But he held out the possibility that if you did third order experiments, if you ever could, you might discover effects of the ego wind. And Poincaré said, no, forget it. To any order you like, you're never going to discover the effects of ego wind. This is just a law of physics. So in a sense, he was elevating the relativity principle to this higher status. And furthermore, this very important step in Einstein's argument, where he shows that k is equal to 1 on the basis of the relativity principle and spatialized entropy, this exact argument appears independently in Poincaré's manuscripts, in his letters. Exactly the same argument. So he's using the relativity principle in this phenomenological sense. It constrains the coordinate transformations. For Lorentz, this scale factor was, to use his exact words, the source of all our troubles. He wanted to get the Lorentz transformations emerging out of the theorem of corresponding states, but he couldn't. He never provided a satisfactory argument as to why k should be equal to 1. Of course, he made up one. But it was on the basis of very, very hand-waving arguments. And Poincaré, on his part, was never happy with that. And Poincaré produced his own argument, and it was exactly the same as Einstein's. So what does this mean? I suppose it means really that, well, later on, of course, when we come to Noether's first theorem, we'll see that figures like Lagrange and others were perfectly aware of the connection between symmetries and conservation principles. So again, there's an example in the history of physics where symmetry principles were regarded as having an important role. But in all of this, what you're really doing is you're taking a system, you're taking a dynamical system. You're looking at some aspect of the dynamics. It's like a higher level aspect of the dynamics, the symmetries of the equations. And you're deriving interesting consequences of those symmetries. Without knowing exactly, without specifying exactly what the equations are, you're just looking at the structural property of the equations. And you're getting a whole lot of interesting stuff coming out. And this really was being played out ever since Newton. So there's a sense in which symmetry is really being a consistent theme. But really, Einstein was, I think, the one that really brought home the efficacy of postulating the symmetry principles ab initio. Whether that's fair to the other pre-historical figures, pre-Einstein figures, I'm not sure. But I think Einstein really did have this effect, because of the power of his derivation of Lorentz transformations. And then next week, we're going to precisely look at why he wasn't very happy with it.
So going back to Newton, then, why didn't he just dump the idea of absolute space?
That's a very good question. And Newton himself, I mean, when you read the Principia, and you read the Scholia, Julian Barber has a phrase which is absolutely perfect. It is shot through with glory. I mean, the Scholia is the most amazing conceptual analysis of the problem of motion. And Newton himself says at one stage, absolute space and time do not come under the senses. We don't see them. We don't bump into them. So when we talk about motion, true and absolute motion, which is the whole point of the Scholium, is to distinguish between merely apparent motions and true motions, absolute motions. And for Newton, this could only be established conceptually by feeling absolute space. And yet at the same time, he says, look, I've built up, I've extracted conceptually this notion of true and absolute motion. For example, if two globes are rotating with respect to absolute space, then there'll be tension in the string. Okay? You can see that. You can tell whether two globes are accelerating, rotating with respect to absolute space. But what you can't do, for example, is tell whether one of the, either of the globes is moving uniformly, translationally with respect to absolute space. But all the time, he's worried about what Barber calls the Scullion problem. How do you go from fundamental notions of motion defined with respect to absolute space to physics? But why ultimately did he think absolute space was necessary? Well, there's a simple reason for that. Descartes had been arguing that motion is merely relative. Okay? So, and in a way, he was arguing this because he wanted to get off the hook of the Inquisition, which had just condemned Galileo. He wanted to say somehow that, you know, well, yes, the Earth moves around the Sun, but in some sense it's not moving. Everything's only really relative. And in a way, he was right. In a way, he was right to do this. What is motion? How do you define true motion? Well, the trouble with Descartes was he also established for the first time the modern principle of inertia. Okay. He also established the principle of inertia, which is the claim that force-free bodies move in straight lines and uniform motions. With respect to what? How do you even define the principle of inertia unless you pick out some backbone of the universe? And Newton correctly saw that Descartes' whole thing about physics, the way he tried to argue that the Earth was both moving and not moving because everything was relative, but at the same time introducing the principle of inertia, was a complete mess. And he said, look, you will not understand what motion is by simply talking about relative motions. Because, as Descartes himself said, if you have a sailor on a ship walking along the decks with a watch, that's to say the clock of things moving inside it, say that spring, what is it moving? Is the spring moving? Yes, it's moving with respect to the clock. But the clock is moving with respect to the boat, and the boat's moving with respect to the shore, and so on and so on. You never know what you mean by true motion. So ultimately, Newton said, true motion is motion with respect to something that's defined independently of bodies. And that's absolute space. And time, true time, is defined with respect to this background flow of some absolute time. That's any way you could make sense of it conceptually. Now he has to turn that concept back into physics, because these things don't come under our senses. And he just about gets away with it. The situation, as he says in the Scullion, is not altogether hopeless. And that's why he introduces the case of the globes. Because there you can tell whether the two globes are accelerating with respect to absolute space or not, with the tension of the string. So it's this curious mixture of the metaphysical with the physical. And he was successful. But it's an incredibly, he's walking along a tightrope. And somehow he gets to the end of the tightrope without falling off. It's sort of a miracle. Can we leave it at that?